You can spot forest fires from airplanes or with drones, but it's cheaper and sometimes more effective to keep your eyes peeled from a fire tower.
Okay, Clearfield, I'm seeing the smoke at 236 degrees at approximately 7 miles.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, Pennsylvania looks to prevent spring forest fires the old-fashioned way, and how controlled fires, managed by conservation professionals, can actually be good for wildlife and hunters.
After these fires, this will be a great place to come in and turkey hunt just next week.
Plus, while plans to bail out Pennsylvania's struggling nuclear industry are stalled in the Capitol, a famous plant will soon be decommissioned.
You know, I think a lot of us hoped it wouldn't be this soon, but they also knew the political realities of the situation.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Researchers have discovered two types of fungi in Pennsylvania are fatal to an invasive insect that's causing a lot of anxiety for farmers and foresters. WITF's Rachel McDevitt has more on the findings, published this month in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Cornell University entomologist Eric Clifton got an email in 2017 from a Penn State Extension representative saying spotted lanternflies have been found dead, covered in fungus, in a park outside Reading. He and his team found two naturally occurring fungi, Bacoa major and Bovaria bassiana, are infecting and killing lanternflies. Clifton says the fungi don't appear to be as damaging to native insects.
Lanternflies, on the other hand, you know, they've never maybe come across these native strains of Bavaria that have been there in the environment. And so they may be more sensitive to the fungus, and therefore you see this widespread mortality.
Clifton says there's no guarantee the fungi can be used to wipe out the invasive lanternfly, which poses a threat to the state's fruit and timber industries and is now found in 14 Pennsylvania counties. He's planning more research into the effectiveness of pesticides that contain the Bavaria fungus, but he hopes these findings can help manage the lanternfly population. Rachel McDevitt in Harrisburg.
And here's some more positive news in conservation. The variety of fish species in the Ohio River has substantially increased since the 1960s. That's according to a new study. Brittany Patterson has more.
A team of researchers from Ball State University and Virginia Tech examined almost 60 years of data collected by the Ohio River Valley Water Sanitation Commission, or ORSANCO. ORSANCO began surveying for fish up and down the Ohio in 1957. Using that data and information on how land use near the river changed, the researchers found the number of species varied from 31 to 90 each year, and increased over time. The data showed the passage of the Clean Water Act in the 1970s was associated with more fish species variety. Ball State biology professor Mark Pyron was the lead author of the study. He said having access to ORSANCO's data was crucial.
If you don't have long-term databases like this where people have collected the same data over a long period of time from the same location, you can't ask questions about whether things are changing or not.
Pyron noted the study used high-level data, so more research is needed to tease out impacts for specific species across the river's 981-mile stretch. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
The Ohio Valley Resource is a public media partnership made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Three Mile Island nuclear power plant near Harrisburg will close as planned on September 30th, says its owner, Exelon. As State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports, the company hoped for a state subsidy law to pass by June 1st to help keep the plant open. But it says that doesn't appear possible in the few legislative voting days that remain.
2 years ago, Exelon said it was planning to shut down Three Mile Island in 2019, but the company said it would try to keep the plant open if Pennsylvania followed the lead of other states, including New York, Illinois, New Jersey, and Connecticut, that have approved billions of dollars in subsidies to keep their nuclear plants open. Pennsylvania lawmakers have been discussing options for more than 2 years, and there are two bills pending in the House and Senate, but neither has moved out of committee. Dave Marcheski is site state communications manager for Three Mile Island and said news of the closure was difficult for the plant's approximately 600 employees.
You know, I think a lot of us hoped it wouldn't be this soon, but they also knew the political realities of the situation.
The plant will continue to operate through the end of September, when it will shut down for decommissioning. All the workers have been guaranteed jobs within Exelon, but many may have to move out of the state. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
There are wildfires in Pennsylvania. They hardly compare to the massive blazes that burn out west each summer. But several hundred smaller fires occur across the state each spring. To better detect them, conservation officials have gone old school. They've just built 16 new lookout towers. As part of State Impact Pennsylvania's ongoing coverage of climate change, Amy Sisk takes you to the Mashannon Forest District.
I'm riding shotgun with three guys from the district through the Pennsylvania wilds. We're taking back roads, swerving around potholes until we come to a fork. John Hecker manages this forest for the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources.
That's the road we'll go to the new tower.
Yep.
And the old tower is just right up here.
These towers are 2 miles apart. Though they function almost identically, the first one we visit can be rickety in the wind. It's 98 years old. Its four iron legs are cemented into the grassy hilltop.
One over there is cracked, but we have three good ones.
That's Larry Bickle. He's a forest fire warden who retired from the Mashannon District 2 years ago. He spent a lot of time staffing the tower we're about to climb.
Do you mind heights, by the way?
Well, we'll find out.
Okay.
60 feet up, we open a wooden hatch to a small room. The view is spectacular. So is the wind. Bickle is at home here.
This is a soul-searching thing. It's not for everybody. I've solved a lot of problems in my life up in this tower.
DCNR built many towers in the 1920s and 30s. Hecker says the state's landscape changed drastically back then.
At the turn of the century, this whole area would have been clear-cut.
The lumber was used to build a growing nation, and massive fires tore through what was left behind. Today, the area is again covered in trees. Joe Pulaski is the fire forester for Mashannon, and he points out that most branches are still pretty bare this time of year.
You can see how, like, the clouds have broken here and the sunlight's coming down, and all the trees don't have leaves on them yet, so you can see how everything would dry out.
By late May, tree leaves will block the sun from reaching the brush underneath, so the ground stays wet after it rains, preventing fires from starting. This is the first fire season for the 16 new towers built in Pennsylvania last year. Gary Weber in Idaho with the Forest Fire Lookout Association was surprised by the project.
First reaction is, really? We'll believe it when we see it.
Over the past few decades, he's seen many states end their lookout programs.
Nationwide, we figure there were somewhere over 9,000 lookout structures built along the way, and probably somewhere a little over 2,500 actually left standing, but a lot of those are just abandoned.
He estimates 500 are still staffed as states turn to other methods of fire detection like planes, cameras, and citizen reports from cell phones. Mike Kern heads DCNR's Division of Forest Fire Protection. He says most of Pennsylvania's new lookouts replaced aging ones at the same location. The agency staffs about 24 towers on warm, dry, windy days in the spring.
There are a lot of places that if people see smoke, they'll get 10 calls to the 911 center. There's other places in north central PA especially that, you know, nobody might see a fire for a couple hours.
Even if someone wanted to report a fire, they'd have a hard time finding cell service out here. That's one of the reasons why five of the new towers are in the Mashannon Forest District. Hecker says the alternative is paying upwards of $1,000 per hour for a plane to search for fires.
Our towers always spot the smoke quicker because just a little tiny column of smoke comes up. They're looking at that against the blue of the horizon and they can spot that.
Humans cause most of the state's wildfires, which tend to be pretty small. Yet in 2016, more than 8,000 acres burned in the Poconos. Kern says the $4 million plus price tag for the new towers is worth it if it means catching fires early.
If we have, you know, one big fire, we could spend $1 million or $2 million to put it out. look at it that way, you can recoup the cost of a tower pretty easily if you can prevent those fires from getting large.
The Mashannon District is no longer using that 98-year-old tower now that a new one has gone up on Chestnut Ridge nearby, with a clearer view to the north. Bickle, who spent much of his career in the old towers, is blown away when he walks in for the first time.
This is much better. You can get a little idea where the valleys are, where the rivers are. You know, I can see where the river flows the whole way through. There's the power plant.
He grabs a pair of binoculars and starts scanning for smoke. Next to him is a round table with a map of the surrounding area. It has a metal bar that spins, with screws sticking up from both ends. When there's a fire, Bickle would line up the screws with the smoke, then call it in. He demonstrates.
Yeah, Clearfield, I'm spotting the smoke. You ready to copy?
Copy, go ahead.
Okay, Clearfield, I'm seeing the smoke at 236 degrees at approximately 7 miles.
Back in the Forest District office, one of the dispatchers, like Kay Robison, gets to work.
And if there is another tower that might be able to see the fire, then we contact them to see if there's anything that they're seeing, any smoke, to kind of cross the hairs to stop the fire quicker.
She can then triangulate its location to direct firefighters on the ground to the flames. She'll dispatch Forest District employees, but DCNR also works with a lot of volunteer fire departments, and sometimes they're closer to the action and can get there first. Bickle recalls one day 5 years ago.
Talked to the tower operator, you know, he said, smoke there, smoke there, smoke there, smoke there, smoke there.
11 fires broke out.
So I was asking State Parks Rangers to chase smoke for me.
This year is much calmer thanks to abundant rain. Mashannon's only staffed its new towers a few days. Statewide, just 500 acres have burned, compared to the usual 3,000 by the start of May. A DCNR report suggests climate change could result in more wildfires, though that hasn't happened so far. Regardless, the new towers will be here for years to come. Their spotters signing off after a long day's work watching the forest.
Clearfield Chestnut Ridge Tower out of service.
Copy that.
Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The logging that happened in Pennsylvania about 100 years ago is still evident today.
We could all go back in our time machines before any of us were around, think about the massive landscape scale clearing of our forests that occurred. When that happened, all of our forests, basically their age became reset.
Later on the Allegheny Front, how conservationists are trying to undo the damage of the last century and create better habitat for wildlife. Stay tuned. A million species of plants and animals are at risk of extinction. That's the state of affairs described in a recently released summary of a UN assessment on global biodiversity and ecosystems. Humans have altered wildlife habitat through development, agriculture, water pollution, and most notably in the assessment, climate change. And if things continue as they are, birds, frogs, and insects won't be the only casualties. The full assessment, to be released later this year, highlights the ways that the health and well-being of people are tied to the biodiversity of plant and animal species. It's a new report, but the problems have been mounting for decades. And it made us think of an interview from a few years ago with Elizabeth Colbert. A staff writer at The New Yorker, Colbert is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. She traveled to places like Alaska and Panama, reporting on climate change and how humans are driving this new age of loss and die-offs on the planet. Here's some of that interview. Extensive travel is part of your reporting on climate change and later as one of the sort of implications of climate change extinction. Of everything that you've seen and experienced, what's stuck with you, an image maybe or a place that stuck with you as you think about the situation that, the planet is in now?
I think the most extraordinary place that I went was the Great Barrier Reef, which is off the eastern coast of Australia. And the scientists that I went to the Great Barrier Reef with, and many other scientists, all are predicting sort of the end of the Great Barrier Reef and really, to be honest, all reefs in the world by the end of this century. And that's a very, very, very sobering thought. And so if you've seen the sort of richness of life on a reef and then to imagine that ceasing to exist is pretty horrifying, and it certainly think it had a big impact on me.
Can you describe some of the things that you saw or that sort of made an impression on you?
Well, when you're on a reef, you know, a lot of people have seen sort of underwater photography of reefs, this sort of this extraordinary richness. It's almost indescribable. It's not something that you can see on land. You cannot simply see that many species gliding by you on land. It's just this experience you don't have as a terrestrial creature. But when you're underwater and you can probably see, you know, hundreds of species of fish and at any given moment just by swiveling your head, and great turtles and rays and sharks all passing by you. It seems to a land creature sort of unreal, almost like a dream landscape.
One of the chapters in this sixth extinction is about bats and the huge number of them that have died recently as a result of white nose syndrome. That's been a big environmental story here in Pennsylvania, but I never really thought about it in the framework that you lay out, the premise that we're entering into the sixth great mass extinction in the history of the Earth and that humans are playing this unprecedented role. Can you talk about that and how your example of bats plays into that?
There are many different ways, and the sort of unifying theme of the book and of science, I suppose, on this subject is that humans are supplanting, taking the place of the great forces of nature, the great geological forces of the past. We are now basically in control of the planet. We may not be controlling it consciously, but unconsciously we are. We're controlling we are changing the composition of the atmosphere. We're changing the chemistry of the oceans. And we're moving species around in ways that they cannot move on their own. So we're effectively bringing the continents into contact again. And white nose syndrome is a very vivid example of this. It's a fungus. It's been traced through very sophisticated genetics to Europe. It might have come over with a single person who, you know, had some on his shoe or her shoe. And we have a pretty good sense of where it entered this country. It entered in upstate New York, not far from where I live, actually. And it has now spread to at least 22 states and 5 Canadian provinces in this classic way in which an epidemic spreads, you know, in sort of a bullseye pattern, killing, as you say, millions and millions of bats. And this is unfortunately just one example of a pathogen that we people moved around the world quite unconsciously that has huge ramifications for other species.
Time as a concept in your books, especially the sixth extinction, is kind of comforting to me that in the history of the Earth, we humans in our time here is just this tiny sliver of the whole. But when I think about your reporting on ice cover in the Arctic and the Antarctic and how it's impacted life on the planet in the past and how human activity is accelerating the melting of glaciers, time starts to feel a little less benign.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm wondering, is time on our side?
Well, I think that's a really interesting way of putting the question. I think that one of the points that I was really trying to convey, it is about time. And as you point out, there have been vast stretches of time before humans arose as a species. And, you know, presumably there'll be vast stretches of time afterwards on this planet, where, you know, life will continue on. But one of the amazing things, and one of the things that I was trying to impress upon people, is that in this relatively short time that modern industrialized society has existed, so since the Industrial Revolution, you know, since oil was discovered in Pennsylvania 150 years ago, not very long, you know, massive changes have occurred on planet Earth, changes on a geological scale. So really, we are changing the planet very rapidly by any standard. Even if you look across all of the history of the planet, the rate of change right now is way, way up there. It's sometimes compared to, you know, the last major upheaval in the history of life, which was the extinction of the dinosaurs, which seems to have been caused by an asteroid impact. So you will often hear scientists, you know, very sober-thinking scientists compare human impacts to an asteroid. And over the great expanse of time, you know, one day when an asteroid strikes the Earth, or, 200 years when humans, you know, are burning through the Earth's store of fossil fuels, they're going to look very much the same in the geological record when, you know, many millions of years have passed.
In your books, humans play kind of a dual role. We're changing the environment, the climate itself, but we're also problem solvers. In the Netherlands, they're experimenting with floating houses to ride out sea level rise. And the many scientists that you talk with who are working so hard to save species from extinction, which side of our nature do you think is winning?
That's a very good question. And I think that certainly right now, the changes that we're affecting quite, you know, heedlessly and unconsciously are outpacing our ability to solve them. But we are very, very clever, and we've been faced with many dire situations in the past, and somehow we're all still here. In fact, there are many more of us now than there ever have been on planet Earth before. So one is tempted to believe, well, we'll figure something out, and I one certainly hopes that, but it's not clear, and I don't necessarily, you know, think that I'm going to be around to see the answer to this, but my kids or my grandkids are going to see this story through in ways that will either be very, you know, inspiring and hopeful, or just the reverse.
Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. There's more of our climate change coverage at AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. We heard earlier about how Pennsylvania is aiming to prevent forest fires. But fire can sometimes be a good thing for forests. It reshapes them. And it's actually being used as a tool to help create crucial habitat for songbirds. Pennsylvania is an important breeding ground for over 100 species of migratory birds. But some of those birds are in decline. So as the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains, the state is fighting for their survival with fire.
In a clearing in the Allegheny Mountains, 25 men in fire-resistant gear gather in a circle.
Today, did everybody get a hold of a map?
Ben Jones is in charge of the Pennsylvania Game Commission's prescribed fire program. He's telling these men, mostly Game Commission officers with special fire training, about today's controlled burn. Jones begins with a weather report, some safety tips, and tells them what they're trying to accomplish today.
Well, this is part of the area that was heavily hit by gypsy moth around 2008, 2009, with a lot of oak mortality. We're trying to tip that balance back to the oak forest that it was before gypsy moth.
The state's had this prescribed fire program for about a decade to maintain different kinds of habitat across the Game Commission's 1.5 million acres of public game lands. Today's fire will cover a 500-acre strip of it in Center County. Jones takes a crew about 1.5 miles down a dirt road into the forest. At the end, he walks down a path.
Fire has been a part of these habitats for thousands of years. Since the glaciers retreated, fires have been burning through these habitats for, pushing 10,000 years.
Some of these fires were set by Native Americans to promote certain types of berry crops or improve hunting grounds. He says this is basically what the Game Commission is doing today.
After these fires, this will be a great place to come in and turkey hunt just next week.
Jones and his team pick a spot to start the fire, where the wind will keep it from spreading too fast once it's set. Gage Meyer, a Game Commission officer from Cameron County, walks around with a large metal can with a spray nozzle attached at the end.
It's a mixture of diesel fuel and gasoline. It's 4-to-1. It's not too potent, but it does the job.
Meyer ignites a clump of leaves that have been doused with the fuel. From there, he and another crew member spray the fuel in a straight line along the path. The fire quickly spreads. The fire burns knee high, turning leaves on the ground black. A wall of heat pulses off the forest floor. This fire will benefit oak trees and wild turkeys, but it'll also create a home for some rare or threatened songbirds. A few miles away, Jeff Larkin, a biologist at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, walks along a flat ridgetop dotted with small trees.
So these guys live, right? These are
pitch pine. Fire came through relatively thick bark.
This forest was burned 2 years ago. There are still scorch marks on some stumps, but small woody plants are quickly taking over the forest floor. Larkin says these fires will help create habitat for some birds that don't need a deep forest to raise their young in.
There are a few species that populations have been plummeting for quite a bit longer, and therefore they're kind of on the conservation radar screen, if you will.
One of the most threatened species is the golden-winged warbler. It's a migratory bird that's currently being considered for protection under the Endangered Species Act. Once abundant, its population has declined by two-thirds since the 1960s. Several states and the federal government are spending millions to keep the species from going extinct. It's a tiny gray bird with splashes of brilliant yellow on its head and wings that give the bird its name. The golden-winged warbler winters in parts of Central and South America that are rapidly being deforested, and then it migrates to North America in the spring, which is pretty amazing for a creature that weighs only 9 grams.
We're talking about like the weight of a quarter or a nickel. Not very much. And you can think about that critter trying to get across the Gulf of Mexico and then find its way back to its breeding grounds.
Those breeding grounds are young forests, like those being created by controlled burns. The birds don't nest high in the trees, but closer to the ground.
Because they got kids that can barely fly. They're trying not to be eaten by hawks and snakes and chipmunks and everything else that wants to eat a songbird. And they're also trying to make sure that there's ample amounts of food.
But that perfect young forest is rare in Pennsylvania. Why? Larkin takes me to another nearby site for the answer. It was burned a couple of years ago, but small trees and shrubs are growing back. A century ago, Larkin says, this field would have probably been clear-cut, like the rest of Pennsylvania's forests.
We could all go back in our time machines before any of us were around, think about the massive landscape scale clearing of our forests that occurred. When that happened, all of our forests, basically their age became reset.
So most forests in the state is about 100 years old. Larkin says this is bad, not just for golden-winged warblers, but for other species that evolved to survive in specific types of forests or wetlands.
Think about our forests before that happened. The thousands of years of structural complexity that developed.
That complexity is in evidence at this site that was burned a few years ago. A few lone hickory trees stand in a sea of blackberry bushes and oak and maple saplings.
Here's a great example of what we call the golden-winged warbler nesting habitat. If we got out in there, you'd have areas of some grasses and some ferns and some other pockets of like goldenrod. And those are the places that they like to seek out to build a nest and to raise their young.
And with any luck, golden-winged warblers will be able to raise their young here this summer. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
You can find more wildlife stories like that at our website, alleghenyfront.org/wildpa. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schumann Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.